Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode... The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing. Was a time of great political corruption, wealth inequality, and loosening of Victorian age morals in the late 1800s.
Tell me, pretty maiden, are the women for the home like you?
No one person embodied all that the Gilded Age promised more than Evelyn Nesbit, a willowy, copper-haired beauty from Philadelphia. Arguably, she was the world's first-ever supermodel. Before she was out of her teens, Evelyn was the most sought-after artist and fashion model in New York City. She was the original It Girl, the model for the Gibson Girl, and her haunting face graced the packaging of almost every commercial product of the age. She rubbed elbows with the rich and famous, and even had time to have a tryst with John Barrymore. Her life was turbulent and eventful, but her fame peaked when she became embroiled in a murder. To share the incredible story of Girl in the Velvet Swing is author Paula Uburo. Welcome, Paula.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Paula, tell my listeners a little bit about the Gilded Age, which is the backdrop for your story of the Girl in the Red Velvet Swing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and a lot of people don't know that the term, Mark Twain actually coined the term the Gilded Age. He had a book that he wrote that came out about that, where he was attacking this the culture at the time, where there was this incredible gap that had grown between the haves and the have-nots. You know, it's post Civil War, Reconstruction, Industrial Revolution, all that stuff. And you had people like the Vanderbilts and Carnegies and the Goulds, all of these, you know, they called them robber barons, who made fortunes. And this is before there were tax, income tax. So they made these huge fortunes with steel and railroads and, you know, all banking. And then you had, at the same time, what was happening was this incredible influx of immigrants, mostly from Western Europe, some from Eastern Europe. And so you had the sort of Ellis Island, you know, you had these people coming in who were being crammed into these squalid tenements down in the Lower East Side in Manhattan. And at the cusp of the century, you had this really kind of an amazing explosion of inventions. You know, if you go back and you think about, you know, the telephone, the telegraph, the telephone, photography, you suddenly could produce pictures in newspapers, whereas before they had been drawings, you know. And then you had the phonograph, you had movies, you had all of this, and this immediate explosion. It really was a period of incredible flux and transition between the Victorian era and whatever the new age was going to be, this new century of progress.
And in the middle of all this exciting time, we discover Evelyn Nesbit, or as you term her in your book, American Eve.
Right, the American Eve, who became Probably everybody knows the Gibson Girl, and she eventually becomes the famous model for the Gibson Girl. But and again, emphasis on the word girl, because so much, as you just said, there was so much trauma and turmoil and upheaval. It's almost like she was living. She was sort of the, she was the representative of what was happening to the country in a way, torn between tradition and then an uncertain future. And she was born on Christmas, which I always thought this was such a sort of poignant and I kind of ironic comment, because she thought when she was little that this meant she would get twice as many gifts as everybody, right? Because she was born on Christmas. And her father was a lawyer, but apparently, and this is always a bad joke, but not a good one, he didn't seem to care about money that much. And he died suddenly when she was only 10 or 11. And and she had a younger brother. And her mother was the classic sort of Victorian housewife and mother who had not been trained to do anything else. And she really didn't know. It was like something out of Dickens. They were evicted from their house. They had to go from family member to live. And then finally, her mother took the two children to Philadelphia and got a job at Wanamaker's and pulled Evelyn and her brother out of school. Evelyn was almost 12 at the time, and her brother was probably, I forget, 9 or 10, and they got jobs working. This is another interesting sort of little sidebar. As far as how old Evelyn is, that may be a question we'll answer later, but for my purposes, she was about 11 or 12 when this happened, and it sounds like something out of a Hollywood script, because she was on the streets of Philadelphia and a woman artist saw this incredibly beautiful child. And as you said, I always think of her too. I think one of the most beautiful, the two most beautiful young girls I had ever seen were Brooke Shields and Elizabeth Taylor when she was a young actress in National Velvet. And Evelyn had that kind of just kind of amazing, natural, striking beauty at such a young age, and natural, no makeup or anything like that. In fact, the picture that I picked for her for the cover of my book, she's 16 years old. She has no makeup on, and it's astonishingly modern looking. That was the thing I liked about it, because she looks like somebody today. She could be a model today. So, but Evelyn is then sort of, serendipitously, she becomes a model for this woman artist. And then the woman artist says, there's a whole colony of women artists here in Philadelphia. You should pose for them. So she begins posing for other women artists. And then finally, someone said, what you need to do is go to New York City. That's where she could make, her face was her fortune. When I first started the book, I really had sympathy for her mother because of the situation she was thrown into. And then very quickly, I started to change my opinion, because we're so familiar today with, stage mothers and I call them stage monsters, because they seem to want to live through their children or live off of them, we could go down the list. And
I'm glad you brought up Brooke Shields just a few moments ago. Her relationship with her mom goes far beyond that of simple, overbearing stage mother. Brooke's mom signed a release that allowed Brooke to be photographed nude at 10 years old for Playboy. On the heels of that abuse, she then did Pretty Baby, where she had to kiss adult actor Keith Carradine when she was just 12. And then the sickest of all to me is Blue Lagoon, filmed when Brooke was 14, the plot being two prepubescent cousins are shipwrecked on a desert island and have a baby together. And a less famous case comes to mind of actor Jeanette McCurdy, who played Sam in the Nickelodeon program iCarly, who, because of the abuse suffered at the hands of her mother, wrote a memoir entitled, I'm Glad My Mom Died.
And in Evelyn's case, her mother, when the opportunity came for her to start posing for some of the prominent male artists at the time, she agreed. Now, Evelyn is still 14, 15 years old, and modeling at the time was considered, a fairly risque, especially at the turn of the century, because whatever had been happening in sort of the you know, in the middle of the 19th century, where you had sort of, you know, you could paint a nude and call it, give it a mythological name and say it was Diana or whomever, and that would be sort of okay. But once photography is entered in the picture and you're seeing real nude women or semi-nude or whatever, that then becomes a scandalous sort of occupation, as was acting. And she became the face of the century. As I said, she became, she was discovered by all the advertisers, and she was on everything. Anything that could reproduce an image, Evelyn's face was on it, often without, I mean, no acknowledgement of who she was. She was just this anonymous model, but people kept, you know, saying, who was this incredibly compelling looking young girl? And she sort of represented everything that as I started doing research, particularly looking at the where images of her appeared. You know, she was sold on penny postcards and sheet music and mirrors and fans and advertising. And in the course of doing my research, I discovered that Ellen Montgomery, who wrote Anne of Green Gables, which is, a classic children's novel, saw a picture of Evelyn. I have that picture in the book, saw this picture of her. And that was the inspiration for her character, Anne of Green Gables, which to me is just, you know, fascinating.
And nobody, of course, unless they, you know, look into things, would have any absolute idea.
She looked so innocent, and she was young and innocent. But she also had this sort of very seductive quality about her, which was just natural. It wasn't anything that she had cultivated. And so she promised, I said in the book, you know, forbidden fruit. And so you get this juxtaposition of these two qualities that were part of what was going on. I mean, a lot of people, maybe people don't know that there was this thriving pornographic industry. They used to call them French postcards at the turn of the century, underground sort of things. And but on the surface, everything was, you know, especially in the upper classes and with the Astor, Mrs. Astor and people like that, the 400, everything was about etiquette and, you know, propriety. So you have these two, again, things happening at the same time. And then Evelyn starts modeling. And then when she decides, she makes an announcement to her mother, who, by the way, once Evelyn started modeling, her mother figured, I don't need to get a job. So she just was living off her daughter, who was working. And the modeling hours were very long. They were down in the lower, I called the bowels, excuse me, the bowels of Manhattan. She was down in the lower Broadway area where all the artists were, you know, sort of like what we would consider the Village area. And she's working these long hours in these kind of dingy, you know, studios. And at this point, though, all of the artists that she modeled for were well known. They most of them were older men, and they felt very protective of her. But her mother would just leave her for hours, you know, and then expect her to just come back to their apartment, which was being paid for with Evelyn's modeling money. And then Evelyn, at the ripe old age of 16, said to her mother, I want to be an actress, because she had been in amateur plays and sang and danced, like I think a lot of children do, you know, in the grammar school. And she was picked to be in what was at that time the most popular show on Broadway, which was Floridora, which had the famous song in it, Tell Me Pretty Maiden, Are There Any More at Home Like You? Right now, one of the myths about Evelyn is that she was one of the Floridora girls. There was this, they called them the sextet. There were these six women who were featured, and they were well-known, already established actresses, performers. Evelyn was in the chorus, but Evelyn was the one everybody was looking at in the background. And one of those people who went to see the show 40 times was Stanford White.
Who becomes the second character, if you will, in this triangle that does eventually lead to murder. Now, I do know that he was an architect and that he designed the Seneca Park Zoo, which is in Rochester, New York, which is my hometown. And he also designed the Rhode Island State House, which is where I reside now. But I digress.
Yeah. Well, so Stanford White was, in my book, I call him the Pharaoh of Fifth Avenue. He was the premier architect, tastemaker. He was, many people considered him a genius. And it's interesting because over time, his ability to, his designs, his architectural plans, which included everything from Columbia University, Washington Square Park, the Arch, Tiffany Buildings, the mansions for the Astors, the Whitneys, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Penn Station, all of these. He had, at any one time, he had something like 60 different architectural projects going. But he was known for, he was the type of person, I always think of him as being like Shakespeare's Falstaff. Everybody loved him. He was the life of the party. Women loved him. Men loved him because he was sort of, he used to say bully a lot, which was something that Roosevelt said. And he kind of looked like Teddy Roosevelt, but he was a big guy with red hair and this walrus mustache and athletic and all of that. And also, so he was able to sort of, again, breach the two worlds of Manhattan at the time. He would put together parties for Mrs. Astor. At one point, he decorated an entire restaurant to look like Versailles with 50,000 white roses. I mean, the excess and the extravagance is sort of mind-blowing at the time. At the same time, he was friends with the artists and the theater people down in Broadway and also the artist community. One of his best friends was Auguste Saint-Gaudens, who, among other things, created what became also something that's central in the myth of Evelyn and also associated with Stanford White, was the statue of the Diana that went on top of probably one of his best known buildings was Madison Square Garden.
Statue that went, the original, I'm guessing, was very scandalous, and there was a whole scandal involved with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
in the papers.
Absolutely.
It was nude.
Yeah. One of the things, White was, some people called him a libertine. So one of the things that White, when after White completed the design for Madison Square Garden, which was a block long at the time, and it was this Moorish design. It was had this tower that was modeled after the Giralda Tower in Spain, and he asked his friend Saint Gaudens to do a sculpture for the top. He wanted Diana, the Diana, the goddess of purity and the hunt, which is interesting. And one of the jokes was that it was the biggest pedestal he ever made for St. Gaudens statue, right? And he and St. Gaudens consulted, and St. Gaudens did this statue of this nude figure of Diana with the arrow. And as I said, you know, you could get away with things in paintings if you called it a mythological character. But a big full-blown, at the time, 18-foot naked woman who pivoted as a weather vane on the top of the building was not going to fly. They said that nannies who were pushing the children in the strollers through Madison Park had to run through because they said they were young bachelors with, you know, binoculars trying to look at the naked Diana. And so the Anthony Comstock, who was the head of the Anti-Vice Society, he sort of waged a one-man campaign of censorship, and White was not going to give in. And they were threatening to, you know, all kinds of litigation and take down the statue. So White decided, he told them he would have his friend design a drapery for it. And the drapery that St. Gaudens put on the statue was designed to come off with the first big wind. And once that happened, they never put it on. In fact, in defiance of everything, White had him put huge arc lights so that you could see it illuminated at night. So not only in the daytime, but now you could see it at night. People said you could see it as far as Philadelphia because it was the tallest point in Manhattan, you know. And that became a sort of symbol of of the decadence. I mean, it's interesting. You had said earlier, what was, you know, the times were like, Oscar Wilde was said that America was the country that went from barbarism to decadence with nothing in between, no civilization in between. And if you really look at the turn of the century, there was a level of what we would certainly consider decadence. I mean, that's the Gilded Age. Everything was sort of shiny and new, and you weren't sure what was really underneath the surface, but everything was in excess.
So now, how did Stanford White, who now at this point sounds like a wonderful man until we go forward, when did he first come across Evelyn?
Well, so Stanford White was a connoisseur of beauty. And one of the ways I think about him, and I talk about it in the book, in fact, Evelyn said, you know, he was like an earthquake, like a force of nature. And whatever mistakes I made were mine. I think she's being too generous in her own memoir. But White was a connoisseur of beauty, and he apparently had a real penchant for young chorus girls. Now, he had a wife out on Long Island who was happily ensconced out there, I guess. And like a lot of rich and powerful men, he had mistresses. In fact, St. Gaudens, the woman who modeled for the Diana statue that I mentioned, was his mistress. So with whom he even had a child. So, but Evelyn at this point, Evelyn is 16 years old. White is 48 years old. He sees her. He is absolutely smitten. He's never seen any. I mean, if you look at some of the chorus girls at the turn of the century, they're not particularly, nearly as beautiful as we might imagine. And so White goes and sees the show 40 times. He insinuates himself into her life by having one of the chorus girls invite Evelyn to he had an apartment on 23rd Street, which during the murder trial that took place, they called his snuggery. He had snuggeries all around the city and in Westchester and maybe as far as Rhode Island, I don't know. But so Evelyn was intrigued, and she gets invited to lunch, and her friend says, oh, this guy's got a lot of money and we'll have a nice lunch. And Evelyn, who had grown up with such dire circumstances, you know, the way she described it was they were lucky if their brother stole a jar of mustard from Wanamaker's and they had mustard sandwiches, you know, kind of thing. So she was intrigued by this. So she showed up at this building, which, again, when you look at it in hindsight, it's kind of horrifying. But his apartments were above the original FAO Schwartz, which was the toy store. So here he's having these young girls come to his apartment. And at least the first time she went, it was all very, quote, innocent. But he said, let me show you what I have up in the upstairs in another floor. So they had the sumptuous meal, and there was another friend of his there and the chorus girl, and they went upstairs, and there was this red velvet swing that was attached to the ceiling, and it was all decorated. There were it was just incredibly decadent with, made to look like a forest and green walls and red drapery. And he said, let me push you on the swing. And he pushed her on the swing, and at the top of a ceiling, he had a paper Chinese parasol, those beautiful kind of paper parasols that they had at the time, and said, try to kick a hole through it. And I mean, you could ask Dr. Freud what that was all about. But so she went home and told her mother about this great man and had this lunch. And he began to insinuate himself into her life. He met with her mother. He became very sort of paternal. He said, oh, you should be living in a nicer apartment. And he paid for them to move into this apartment that he decorated. And it was all sort of, whether her mother was that dumb and naive or just willing to turn a blind eye, who knows? But White was the one, he introduced her to artists, friends of his, including Charles Dana Gibson, who immediately saw how incredible she was. And she became the Gibson girl. I mean, he had other models, but she was the one who's the most famous. In fact, it's sort of always the image of the turn of the Gilded Age and the turn of the century, the eternal question, which became then the image that they used in the play and in the movie Ragtime in the musical, that image. So now Evelyn is modeling for big time artists and advertisers. White said, oh, those other guys, they were all old stiffs. You know, I'm going to introduce you to more exciting people. And then she would go to parties at Madison Square, the Tower parties. He would have these lavish parties. And the craziest thing is, so Evelyn is now, she gets into another show called The Wild Rose, which again, she's not a main player. She's sort of in the chorus, but yet the person, George Lederer, who was putting the show together, said that it was named after her. So Evelyn is now modeling in the daytime, performing at night in these musicals. And her mother is just sort of enjoying her life and not working, living off the money, never goes to pick up her daughter. She just assumes she's going to come home, after the show. And up until that point, White was acting very paternal, and he would pay for a handsome cab to take her, to her apartment and whatnot. And that was sort of the relationship until it was not.
So tell us about the first time it was not.
Well, one week, White approaches Evelyn's mother, and he had gone so far as to pay for her to get. She had a small chip in her front tooth. It was her sort of one imperfection, right? Because she had fallen when she was ice skating, and he said, "I'm going to take you to a dentist. I'm going to have you go to the dentist, and it's going to be, and you'll be perfect." And so these are the kinds of things he was doing. So he said, he approached her mother one day and he said, "Listen, it's not good to leave your family for too long and be separated from your relatives. So if you want to go back to Pittsburgh, I can watch, I'll watch Evelyn while you're gone." And Evelyn's mother went and left her all alone at 16 in New York City. And the day after that happens, White tells her that there's going to be a party, which she had been to many parties. There's going to be a party at the Tower, and he'll pick her up after the show and after her performance. So she shows up, and there's nobody there. And he says, "Oh, isn't it terrible? No, but everybody said that they couldn't come." So she said, "Oh, well." And then he said, "Let me show you another room that I have upstairs. It's a different room. It's not one that you've seen." And he ushers her into this room that is literally from floor to ceiling with mirrors. And there's just this big canopy bed in the middle of it, and a table. And the way Evelyn describes it was a table with a bottle of champagne and one glass. And prior to that, when she had gone to parties, she asked if she could have champagne. And he said, "No, no, no, you can't have any champagne." And so he said, "Listen," he says, "it's a special night, and you can have some champagne." So he gave her champagne. Now, I've gone over this a million times in different versions and Evelyn's versions of things. The only thing I will say is that whether or not it was drugged or whether or not she just got drunk and passed out, whatever the situation was, and whether she passed out or not is another question. But according to Evelyn's account of it in her own memoir, she said, "I went into that room a virgin, and I did not come out one." And she describes having had the champagne, feeling dizzy, feeling weird, falling asleep. And the next thing she remembered, waking up with a naked Stanford White next to her. And she was wearing just this almost nothing, this little sort of pink negligee kind of thing or whatever. And he said, "Now you're mine." And he called her his kittens. And now you've got this married man who is, as I said, 48 years old with this 16-year-old girl. And I think the hardest thing for me to reconcile when I was working on this story was, it shouldn't be a surprise to us when you have rich and powerful figures like a man like White, who could on the one hand be so incredibly generous and an artistic genius and however else you want to describe him, and be this just, this terrible, evil thing beneath the surface as far as his taking advantage of young girls. And I have to assume that Evelyn, of course, was not the first that this happened to. But the one thing he hadn't counted on was that Evelyn was despite her incredible beauty, or in addition to her incredible beauty, she was a really smart, she was a very precocious, smart, intellectually curious young woman. She had wanted to be a lawyer in Vassar. That's what she had told her father when she was little. And of course, the sad thing is that went out the window the minute that he died. But White found himself incredibly attracted to her, not just because of her beauty, but also he wanted to give her piano lessons. He sort of wanted to, you know, cultivate her in some way, like a Svengali, I guess. And Evelyn describes again in her memoirs that she wrote, and I talk about in the book, at that point in her life, she had no money. She had no education. I mean, her mother had all of her money. She had no control over anything. White was incredibly generous to her. And again, you know, you could talk to Dr. Freud and say if there's some kind of thing going on with the father figure, but whatever was happening, Evelyn decides that she might as well continue this relationship and be his mistress. And I get angry when people say, oh, well, she was just this little gold digger. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, she was a 16-year-old girl. Think about if you were, when you were 16, how emotionally mature or anything you were. And now go back 100 and, you know, 20 years or whatever. So White then, she becomes his mistress.
And mom doesn't know, or says she's never told mom at this point.
No, she has not told her mother what happened, knowing that that would be probably the worst thing. She doesn't know how her mother would react. But so the mother is going along blithely, accepting money from White. White at this point is also paying for her brother now to go to military school in Pennsylvania. So he's pretty much locked up the entire family and indebted to him. And Evelyn doesn't see a downside, although, and I think this is true, she is in love with him as much as a 16-year-old girl is in love with, you know, can be in love with somebody in any kind of a emotionally immature way, let's say. But when she turns 17 and he starts now showing attention to other girls, she's getting jealous. And she, unlike other, I guess, girls that he had been with, and I use the girl very deliberately, you know, she's getting jealous. And so she's trying to figure out the way that a 16-17-year-old would, how do I make him jealous? So she finds a way, and that way was John Barrymore. So John Barrymore, who was known as a great profile and who is Drew Barrymore's grandfather, in fact, was this well-known figure in Manhattan as well. He was not an actor at the time that Evelyn met him initially. He was his father was a famous actor. His sister and brother, Ethel and Lionel, were both famous actors. And he was sort of avoiding, he said in his own memoir, he said he was avoiding the family curse, but he inherited the other one, which was drinking. But at this point, he's only 22, very young, and Evelyn is 17. And she decides she meets him at a party at Stanford. Stanford White has a party. Evelyn met all kinds of people at White's party. She met Edison. She met Nijinsky. She met Sitting Bull. You name any of these people who were, anybody who was in any kind of way a celebrity or a cultural icon ended up at one of White's parties. But Evelyn meets Barrymore, and he, being very dashing and young, and I will add penniless, asks her for her phone number. And this is where it's so funny, because the modern sort of element of this, he asks her for a phone number and he writes it on the cuff of his shirt, right? And then she thinks this is going to be the trick that's going to get Stanford. She called him Stanny, by the way, at this point. This is going to make him jealous. Well, White is already a little nervous that she's too smart for him and too smart for her own good. And she might actually cause a problem for him at some point, having no idea what would happen. And so he's more than happy to let her go off with Barrymore. So she's both hurt, but then she's just deciding how much she likes Barrymore, because he was incredibly witty and handsome and funny and young and all these things. And so, but one night She and John Barrymore, or they called him Jack at the time, really, but she and Jack were down in Little Italy, and they had too much red wine. Now, mind you, she's 17, but okay. I don't think anybody's checking any ID cards at this point. And she said she was too tired to go home. She was sleepy. So they stayed at his apartment. And the way I love this description, again, I have nothing to refute it, but I'm not sure that I necessarily believe the story that she tells, because she says that she slept all night on his father's cloak from The Count of Monte Cristo, which is one of his father's favorite famous roles, and John slept on a pile of books over in the corner of the apartment. And whether or not that's true, she wakes up the next morning, and it's like that Everly Brothers song. Uh-oh, wake up, little Susie. Guess what? We're in trouble, because it's the next morning. And amazingly, up until this point, she had never not come home, whether it was 2 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock, but she had never not come home. And so now she's nervous at the way any kid child would be, like, oh, my mother's going to kill me. And when she gets to her apartment, Barrymore goes with her, and he's very gallant about, I'll go in with you, you know, I'll help you face the music. And that she opens the door, and there's Stanford White with her mother. And now she doesn't know what to do. White is looking at her. I try to imagine this scene. It's almost like a farce. And Barrymore, being the impulsive young romantic whatever, says, "I'll marry you." And White says, "What are you talking about?" And he says, "We'll live on love." And the mother's horrified, because the mother doesn't want to lose her cash cow. She doesn't want. So she's like, "No, no, no! This is not happening. Your family is all crazy. You know, it's well known." And so White, I guess, and her mother had a plan. They're going to send her off to, I always say, the fate worse than death. They send her off to New Jersey. They send her off to the Mrs. DeMille School for Girls, which is, in fact, Cecil B. DeMille's mother had a school for young women that she ran. And apparently White had sent several girls there. But Evelyn is she's horrified, because her plan didn't work. And now she's, not only is she not going to be modeling or acting, she's going to be going to school in an all-girls school somewhere, you know, in New Jersey. I think it was Pompton Lakes, New Jersey. And that was the end of Barrymore. He would go to the school. Initially, he came to the school, and he would leave notes for her on the trees by the tennis court. But eventually he gave that up, and she realized that White had moved on from her. So it was a weird moment in her life. I mean, all this, by the way, she isn't even 18 yet. And then there's another sort of cataclysmic thing that happens to her. Now, this is one of the big issues that gets debated by so-called experts on, you know, Evelyn Nesbit, that they said, oh, she went there to have an abortion. And I will say this. First of all, I've seen images of her, pictures of her at the school in newspapers at the time, because she was still sort of a celebrity, and they would eventually, here's Evelyn in her school, you know, outfit. Evelyn, contrary to what people might think, and of course she was played in one version of a film, The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing, by Joan Collins, who was fairly, you know, had this hourglass figure. Evelyn was actually very petite. She almost had a boyish figure, which plays into other things as well. But she was a model. She was, you know, at the time she was thin and very lithe and waifish. And these people that say she had an abortion, I'm like, well, what proof do you have of that? You know, because what happened was Evelyn had an attack of appendicitis and was in this school. And keep in mind, this is, you know, 1903. So this is not exact 1902, 1903. So the medical profession is not what it was today, what it is today. And they said she has to have an emergency appendectomy in a classroom. They can't even take her to the hospital, right? Now, again, if they're going to do some sort of secret abortion, they're not going to do it in the classroom of a school where there are all these girls and everything. But that's one of the things that people like to say. Mrs. Nesbit is desperately trying to get a hold of White, and she can't. And so she knows that there's another man who's interested in Evelyn, And that is the infamous Harry Thaw, who had been following Evelyn's career. He was sort of, Harry Thaw, by the way, spoiler alert, is the man that she ends up marrying. But Harry Thaw was this young, relatively young. He was only twice her age. White was three times her age, and Harry Thaw was twice her age. He was 36, I think, when she met him. And he was the son of a railroad and coal magnate. The Thaws were a hugely important family in Pittsburgh. And Evelyn knew of the Thaw family because where she grew up in Trenton, it was sort of in the shadow of the Thaw mansion. Oh, then there's this guy who's been sort of stalking her surreptitiously, sending her notes. But she would get notes from hundreds of admirers when she was on the stage. He also saw her in The Wild Rose and in Floridora, but he never introduced himself to her. And Harry was the way that my favorite description is that Sanford White was a genius and Harry Thaw was not quite an imbecile, which
I love it. But we must point out, as in all these people, a very rich imbecile.
Yes, very rich. His father died when he was 18 and his mother doted on Harry. She was the oldest. He was the oldest child and she doted on him. I mean, literally, she was the absolute monstrous smothering, enabling mother. And Harry had been thrown out of, he had gone to Harvard, he had gone to another private school, and each time he would get in trouble for crazy behavior and they would just pay off the people and he would, you know, go on his merry way. And so at this point, he is just a playboy. Harry just, when his father died, he knew that his son had issues, had probably had mental issues. And by that, I mean, he seemed to have, he liked to talk in baby talk. He had sort of this infantile side to him, and he had anger issues. And I don't even know what they would qualify it as today. But I said in the book, he has a smorgasbord of personality quirks. And so what happens is Harry had been sending her notes. And just before she went off to the school in New Jersey, but he wasn't signing them as Harry Thaw. He was signing them as this guy, Mr. Monroe. So he was using an alias, right? At one point, this is only a few months before the whole incident with Barrymore. Suddenly, there was a piano delivered to the apartment, and it was from Mr. Monroe. And Evelyn says, "I don't care who this guy is." At that point, she's with Barrymore, and she's trying to, you know, make White jealous. And this Mr. Monroe seems just like a creep and a stalker. And so she's. But he would send a dozen roses with a $50 bill attached to them, which I think should be insulting. And the thing that I like to say is that her mother sent back the roses but kept the money, right? So Evelyn is not in charge of anything in her life. She has no agency at this point in her life in this culture. But one day she gets a note from Mr. Monroe saying, "Would you meet me for lunch?" And one of her friends, chorus girlfriend, says, "Oh, come on, he's a rich guy. We'll get a free lunch. What do you care?" And she's like, I guess so. She was so depressed because this was now just before she's going to be going to to the girls' school. And this guy shows up. And it was Rector's Restaurant, which was a famous restaurant at the time. And he kneels down and he kisses the hem of her dress. And she's like horrified. And he says, "You're the most beautiful woman I've ever seen." And she's like, okay. And he says, "And I am not Mr. Monroe." And then he stood up and he says, "I am Harry K. Thaw of Pittsburgh." And Evelyn said in her own memoir, she said, "I don't know what he expected me to do, faint." I mean, she said he was kind of disturbing looking because he was also above average in height. He was over 6 feet tall, but he had this sort of baby face. It was like this. I always think it's so sort of creepy. He has this child's face on a man's body, you know, he tells her that he loves her. And she's like, "Well, okay." And then fast forward to the incident at the school. She told her mother about this, and her mother, and this is another interesting little thing that I discovered in doing my research when I was writing the book, when Mr. Nesbitt died, Mrs. Nesbitt was in such dire straits. Harry Thaw's mother, Mother Thaw, she ran a local charity, and Mrs. Nesbitt actually went to their house to ask for money. And Mrs. Thaw, for whatever reason, didn't give it to her. There was some bad feeling there. So there was no good feelings about the Thaw family. But when Evelyn fell sick in this girls' school, her mother, and when she couldn't get a hold of White, says, "I'll go to the second next best thing," which is this millionaire. And Harry was the, it sounds crazy, but this is actually true, and I've seen it documented. Harry was the guy who would light his cigars with $100 bills, and, you know, he would throw these elaborate, it would be in the newspapers because of the things that he did. His behavior was so crazy and so extravagant. He hired John Philip Sousa to play at one of his parties, and he rode a horse into the Union Club. I mean, he did all this kind of stuff. But he had money. In fact, a monthly allowance from his mother at the time was $80,000, which is astonishing. I mean, it's mind-boggling. And again, there's no income tax. So Mrs. Nesbitt, contacts Harry Thaw and says, "We need help." And Harry, the knight in shining armor, comes to this girls' school, brings with him the best doctor. They perform this appendectomy. And then the doctor suggests that she needs a long recuperation period. And Harry offers to pay for a trip for her and her mother to go to Europe. And Mrs. Nesbitt, true to form, says, "That sounds like a thing." But she didn't know that Harry was going to include himself in the trip. And that is another whole, then it goes to another level of, I mean, if you want to talk about from barbarism to decadence, once she is with Harry, those two things, the barbarism and the decadence, really come to the surface. And if White was a kind of Jekyll and Hyde, I would say that Harry was mostly Hyde, you know? And then that's the next situation that Evelyn finds herself in at 17.
And a little bit of fast forward, she does ultimately marry him. How long after the, or on the trip, or after the trip, does the proposal accepted by her mother? No, I'm just kidding. Right. when does the proposal happen?
Well, what happens is Evelyn goes on this trip, and Evelyn feels sorry for Harry. She does the one thing she does, which is really the worst. I think I said it's the worst mistake of her life. She tells Harry what happened with Stanford White. Harry Thaw has hated Stanford White for his entire adult life because Harry Thaw was a big shot in a lot of places, but not in New York City. And since Stanford White was the was either the architect or a member of almost all of the exclusive men's clubs, and Harry, because of his behavior, because he was just some guy from Smoky City, you know, Pittsburgh was not considered anything to the people in New York particularly. And so even though one of his sisters married one of the Carnegies, but so Harry hates White. And so when Evelyn tells him this, he becomes obsessed with avenging her and all of the girls, all of the young virgins that he feels have been taken advantage of by White. But they go, so when they come back to New York, he keeps pursuing Evelyn. He keeps asking her to marry him. And she said, I won't. I don't want to get married. I don't want to marry you. And at the same, and she, in the back of her mind, she's like, she knows he's obsessed with virgins and virginity. And it's just, she doesn't understand why he wants to marry her. But given the context of the time, she's looking at her situation at 18, almost 19. And she's thinking, okay, well, let's see. I have no education. I will have no reputation. I have, you know, because of my relationship with White. I mean, good girls weren't mistresses of rich men at the time, and they and never ended well for the mistresses, right? So, and Harry gets on his best behavior, and he's telling her how much I love you, and I'll take care of you, and we'll do all the things you always wanted to do. We'll go to Paris, and you can study sculpture. And so the second worst mistake of her life is that at the age of 19, she agrees to marry Harry Thaw and become the sort of mistress of the second mistress of the Thaw Mansion in Pittsburgh. I think it's very symbolic that the day that she marries Harry, she's dressed in black. She doesn't wear a white wedding dress or anything. She's wearing a black dress that's a traveling outfit because Harry says, we're going to go on this big European honeymoon. And so that, and Evelyn marries him at 19. And at least for a year, she thinks that maybe this is going to work out. Harry is true to his word. He's sort of on his best behavior. But he's not, after their honeymoon, she's sort of locked in this mansion. Then she becomes sort of like a lot of the Gilded Age heiresses, the young women, like the Consuela Gould, who, you know, her parents said, you're going to marry this count or whoever. And they're miserable. And she's in this mansion with Mother Thaw, who is this monstrous, frightening figure. I mean, if you look at the images of her that I've seen, are just frightening. And after her husband died, she wears this black gown and this black veil like Queen Victoria. That's who she modeled herself on. So you've got this, and she was a big woman. So you've got this woman who's sort of haunting this house that they live in. And she's very so-called religious and everything else. And Evelyn starts to see cracks in the facade with Harry because he held it together for about almost a year, and then he started obsessing again about Stanford White and coming into her room at night because they had separate bedrooms because that's what you did back then, and say, tell me again what he did to you and this kind of stuff. And Evelyn was like, ugh. And I mentioned earlier that White had her teeth fixed. And when she told that to Harry, he made her go to a dentist and have all of the work undone and then redone with his dentist, which is, I mean, think about that even in contemporary terms. Like, you don't want to go to the dentist and have your bridge work or whatever things taken out. And this is when they had foot pedals and they didn't have, you know, anesthesia and things like that. So this torturous thing that he puts her through just because he wants to erase any trace of Stanford White.
One of the things that you do point out in the book is, again, this jealousy that comes forward, that obviously it's going to be when they're back in New York or when she's in New York that he keeps asking her, did you, you know, have a chance meeting? And she would confess, I saw standing on the street. And right. that was probably not something she should have done.
Right. He had private detectives following her, knowing that, I mean, it sounds funny because New York seems it's a big place, but even and it was a big place then. But apparently, if you're running in the same circles or in the same general area, you do run into people. And Harry would say, did you see Stanford White? Because what happened was Harry said, we're going to go on a second honeymoon. We're going to go visit my sister, the Countess of Yarborough, I think it was. Countess of Marlborough, I forget what the actual designation was. But she said, oh, okay. And so he says, we're going to leave from New York on June 27th. So they go to New York and they stay in this, in a very nice, one of the nice hotels. And Harry says, oh, we're going to see a show tonight. And Evelyn says, what? He says, we're going to go to a show tonight to see this show. It's a brand new show called Mademoiselle Champagne. And Evelyn says, she thinks this is very strange. Now, I have to preface this by saying it's June, and June can be warm, but it was excruciatingly hot this particular June this week. And I mention that because it's important later on. So Harry, so that night they go out to a restaurant. They go to Martin's restaurant, and who comes walking in while they're eating dinner but Stanford White and his son. And Evelyn sees it at first, and Harry doesn't because of the way they're seated. And so she now is a nervous wreck. She's like, oh, I don't want a scene. I don't want to, this isn't going to be good. I don't want any kind of an ugly scene. And she figures she'll sort of diffuse it. So she writes a little note to Harry saying that the bee is here. And that was short for the beast, because that's how Harry referred to White, as the beast. So he looks at the note and he puts it in his pocket and smiles. And she thinks, well, he took that pretty well. Okay. And they get up and leave. So they're going to go to this show, and it's at Madison Square Garden. Now, Madison Square Garden is the most identifiable thing with Stanford White in the city, probably. And Harry knows about what happened to Evelyn. And they've got the statue of the Diana, the naked Diana, who's pivoting above the, because it was a rooftop theater, outdoor theater that they had. And so, and I will say that Madison Square Garden had one of the only elevators in New York. So Harry and Evelyn and a friend of his, two friends of his, he invited to go to the show. So they sit down and they're watching the show. And apparently the show was terrible. And they said the music, it was just awful. Because White was such a bon vivant and so much of a part of the theater scene, everybody expected he would be there for opening night. But he had his own table right at the front, near the front of the stage. And he wasn't there. So the show is bad. Evelyn is thinking, let's just go. I'm really uncomfortable here. This is just not where I want to be. And the elevator doors open, and who comes out? Who steps out but Stanford White? And there's, you know, a murmur in the crowd, like, oh, Stanford White, here you know. So he comes walking in, and Evelyn sees that, and now she's like, oh, no. Oh, now I really want to leave. And Harry gets up and walks away from the table, and she doesn't see him for a few minutes, and then he comes back. And she goes, Harry, let's leave. And his friends go, yeah, this is terrible. Let's go. So Evelyn and the two other men start walking towards the elevator. And when she turns, Harry is not behind her. And she's wondering, she's looking around. And then, you know, however many feet away, yards away, Harry has, and by the way, I mentioned before, it was almost 100 degrees. It was really hot that night. Harry had been wearing this big, heavy overcoat the whole time, this big black overcoat. And, I contend, and I think it's common sense that he did it because he was hiding what he had in his coat, which was a gun. And he walked up to White, shot him three times, shot him point blank range in the head. And two of the bullets, two went into his head, one went into his shoulder. He fell dead at the floor. People were watching the show because the show was going on. And some people thought it was part of the show. You know, they heard. And then it was only the people nearby who saw, and women started screaming and running. And now imagine this is, you know, however many, eight stories up, and you've got this rooftop garden theater, and people are running to get away from this guy. And Harry holds up the gun and he yells, I did it because he ruined my life. Now, what's interesting, I mean, wife, sorry, I just made a mistake. Harry said, I did it because he ruined my wife. But there were several people, when the police spoke to them later, he ruined my life, which I think is a very interesting thing, because there's a definite difference between saying he ruined my life and he ruined my wife. And an off-duty fireman approaches Harry and says, give me the gun. And Harry gives it to him, and he's smiling. He's happy. And Evelyn is saying, Harry, what have you done? And then they take him to the police station, the local police station, where, and I love this, he gives a fake name. He says his name is Mr. Schmidt. And everybody knows it's Harry Thaw.
Now, just as a quick sidebar, yeah. You said that everybody, you know, is running and racing. I'm assuming there were steps up there as well as the elevator.
Yeah.
Obviously, the elevator, you're not all going to, you might, some people might have run to the elevator, but so there were stairs. So I'm envisioning a partial or full stampede.
Absolutely.
If there's one staircase or even two, you know, people falling down, and you know,
exactly.
Hopefully nobody else. I don't have anything information that anyone was trampled or killed in the
aftermath. But once people got down in the street, there was total chaos, and their cabs and the horse-drawn cabs, there were car cabs, and there was just this total chaos. And I think one of the most poignant, saddest things, images for me of the evening. So Harry is now in prison. Evelyn is with one of her course girlfriends, because Harry has kept her separated from everybody. Her mother, by the way, at this point has her mother, once she married Harry, her mother met a wealthy man and remarried, and kind of was estranged from Evelyn. She's like, well, I got what I wanted now. So, and you've got this crazy husband. So I'm going to go and live with my husband in Pittsburgh and we'll be fine. But that night, White's son had said, I'll meet you at the theater with one of my friends. He was visiting. I think he was going to Harvard at the time and he was home from school that weekend. And so for the entire night, until they came and removed White's body, his son was just sort of standing over the body. And another crazy little detail is that White's brother-in-law had been in the audience, Bessie Smith's brother. His name was James Clinch Smith. And when the people were filing out to get out of, you know, once sort of things settled down, he didn't even recognize him because he was so disfigured by the blast of the gun. And I say it's an interesting sidebar, a weird little sidebar, because he was going to die 6 years later on the Titanic.
Sure, why not?
So, yeah, so it's just these kinds of things, you just can't make it up, you know. And so now what is this is setting the stage for, no pun intended, for the what was being called the trial of the century, you know, and it was the trial of the new century. Every century has its trial, apparently, you know. And I remember when I was working on the book, the O.J. Simpson trial was happening in 96. And so it was literally this happened 6 years into the century. And the O.J. Simpson was happening now 6 years before the end. And there were so many parallels. It was kind of crazy to me of celebrity and murder and jealousy and celebrity trials and the media. And, you know, in this case, as soon as it hit the papers, Harry was sent to the Tombs. And because Harry was crazy and privileged and thought that he could get away with anything. In fact, he thought he was going to get on a boat the next day and go to Europe. He really did, because he didn't try to hide it. You know, he thought, I'm saving all these young girls from this terrible guy. Meanwhile, something I had mentioned, and again, you should read it in the book, but Harry was known for beating and scalding girls in bathtubs and dog whips and handcuffs. I mean, there's a whole other thing going on with Harry, but in his mind, he was the defender of purity and American womanhood. And so this trial is set to, you know, the next year. And keep in mind, Evelyn, this is all happening before she's 21 years old. And the biggest decision now, of course, is she going to testify in her husband's defense? Is she going to testify at all? Is she going to get on a stand and talk about her relationship with Sanford White? I mean, this really was the crux of the matter, and both sides had had really high powered lawyers. What I love is that the defense, the Harry's defense team tried to use the defense of they called it Dementia Americana, which was a new term. And they were trying to say that it was really the unwritten law that a very Victorian approach, that a man has the right to defend his wife's honor. And of course, I would have pointed out, well, that was 3 years after the fact, and he had plenty of opportunity to do that, but for whatever reason. And the prosecuting attorney was William Travers Jerome, who was Jenny Jerome's cousin, who was Winston Churchill's mother. So you've got all this, anybody familiar with the Bronx, Jerome Avenue, that was the Jerome family. And he is this vicious, they called him the courtroom tiger, and he wants to get this Harry Thaw guy. He doesn't like this rich guy thinking he's going to get away with murder. And the unfortunate thing, of course, for White is there's nobody to defend him at this point. Anybody who were friends, all of the, you know, the wealthy, the people who are well-connected, they didn't want to be associated with the scandal, so they all kind of hightailed it out of town for the duration of the trial. Even John Barrymore, he was called to be a witness, and Barrymore didn't want any part of it. And he went up to Maine and kind of hid out there to avoid the subpoena. And I always think it's funny because in one little article where I read when I was doing the research, it said that he was relaxing in Poland Spring, Maine. And I just thought that was so funny because I get Poland Spring delivered to my house. But so this trial starts, and the media, it's very, I mean, it is literally in the headlines of the newspaper for an entire year. The defense is that he was defending, you know, his wife, and White had defiled her. And the only way that was going to work was if Evelyn got on the stand and talked about it. And again, this is one of these moments of contention. E.L. Doctorow, who wrote the book Ragtime, which is his fictionalized version of, you know, he was a brilliant historical novelist and very, very kind to me. But when in his book Ragtime, because Evelyn's story is one of the stories in there with Harry Thaw, and he writes that Evelyn was going to be paid $1 million or whatever it was, $2 million to testify in Harry's defense. I have no doubt that they probably said, look, if you go on the stand, right now Mother Thaw is in charge of all the money. So she's like, if you go on the stand and you say what we want you to say, that he drugged you, that you weren't a willing participant in anything with him, and that, you know, then we'll compensate you. So Evelyn, whether or not that, there's nothing ever written about that, but in any case, Evelyn got on the stand and told everything that was happening, and it was so shocking to the country. Now, keep in mind, this is 1907, so the country is changing, right? And this whole narrative that had been set up about where White was the evil, lecherous, you know, villain, like in a melodrama, the older man who took advantage of the sweet young thing, and Harry's the knight in shining armor, and Evelyn is this innocent little victim country girl who comes to the city. That narrative starts to unravel when facts are coming out about all of them. And it is true that White was a lascivious, seducer and rapist, if you want to use that term. I don't see why not, but he of these, certainly of Evelyn, but Harry was this sadistic, perverted, obsessive, you know, he was like a doppelganger of a much darker doppelganger of White. He didn't have any of the genius or the artistic or anything else on his side. And Evelyn was not the innocent young girl, you know, the fact that she stayed with White for however many months, and, you know, so, but the trial goes on, and in an astonishing development, there's a hung jury. They cannot decide whether or not Harry is guilty or innocent of this crime, even though he did it in front of 1,000 people, premeditated. I say he had the gun ready to go. He knew he was good. I think even because he had, as you said earlier, he had, you know, private detectives constantly following Evelyn. I know he had them following White. He probably knew where White was going to be at any point that evening, and just decided, this is my last chance. And so, you know, shoots him on top of the theater. I don't think, and I'm absolutely convinced Evelyn never thought it would come to that, something like that. She thought there'd be like an ugly scene of, you know, arguing or whatever. But she said Harry was a coward. And the way he treated women is a good evidence of that. And there was also evidence that he had been a drug user, cocaine and things like that. But amazingly, and a lot of people don't know this, they had another trial the next year. And the most significant aspect of it, I think, is that up until then, his lawyers very rightfully said, listen, we're going to go with an insanity plea and we'll get you off. And Mother Thaw and Harry both said, no, I am not insane. And there was even evidence that there were other institutionalized people in Mother Thaw's side of the family. So that being the case, finally, it was a second group of lawyers too. The second group of lawyers said, listen, if you want to see your son fry in the electric chair, that's fine with us, but we're still getting paid, you know. And so they then, I think she decided, yeah, maybe that is the thing. And at this point, Evelyn is so angry at Harry. And, you know, she loved White despite everything. And her life was now ruined. I mean, this was never going to go away. And she was now going to be known forever as the girl in the red velvet swing, because that came out during the trial. They're even selling little red velvet swings on Fifth Avenue, right? So with the second trial, they said, we're going to prove that he's crazy. And Evelyn said, I have no trouble, you know, attesting to the fact of Harry's behavior. And they hired 10 alienists. Of course, that was the, you know, the term for pre-psychiatrists, the alienists. They hired 10 alienists at $1,000 a day to testify to all of Harry's mental problems since he was a child. And at the end of that, so a year later, he is found innocent by reason of insanity and sent up to Matawan, to the hospital for the criminally insane. And now Evelyn finds herself completely isolated and alone with Mother Thaw. So she has no money of her own. She's never, through any of this, she's never had any money, right? First, her mother had control of it. White did. Harry did. Now the mother does. And since Harry is technically insane, the mother has control of everything, her mother-in-law. And Evelyn goes up to visit him at the insane asylum. And then other things happen. One is that Evelyn becomes pregnant in 1909, and she claims that it's a result of a conjugal visit with Harry in the asylum. And there are those that say that absolutely is what happened, that in fact, this was her way to maybe get money, if not for her, if she had a child with him. There are those that say, how could that happen? Well, I know how it can happen because I actually went up there when I was doing my research and looked at some of the files they had in the archives. One of the people there, it's now a prison, but it was an insane asylum for the criminally insane. And they had pictures of Harry in the town driving around in cars and buying ice cream for kids. So the joke was, you know, Harry was not, hardly was he incarcerated. And in fact, he escaped. So in the midst of all this, Harry got tired of trying to prove that he was not insane. And the joke was that the milkman left the back door open, and it was clearly an orchestrated thing. And his friends picked him up, and he ended up went back up to Maine and then Canada. And William Travers Jerome's like, I'm bringing this guy back. So you have this whole sort of second level story here of this chase and this trying to bring him back. And the thing about Harry was he was never very good about hiding who he was. He would tell, I'm Harry K. Thaw of Pittsburgh. So eventually he was caught and brought back. And eventually he is declared sane and let out of the asylum. And his first thing is to divorce Evelyn, who now has this young son. And that's sort of the arc of that whole story. But the thing I like about Evelyn's story is that she's sort of like the phoenix. She keeps rising out of her own ashes. And so her son, Russell, was inherited whatever adventurous spirit she had, because he became a pilot and he was friends with Amelia Earhart. He knew Lindbergh. He was a flyer. He was an important figure in early aviation. Russell Thaw, and they're great. I have some great images of him as a young man, you know, flying at that point in time, at the same time as Lindbergh and then Earhart and these people. And he eventually ended up working in the airplane industry out in California, where the Lockheed, where they made all the planes for World War II and stuff. So. Well, I have a page on Facebook devoted to Evelyn. I'm sort of a Luddite, old school person. So, I don't really have a website, but certainly if you go to Facebook and go to the page, it's the American Eve, page. There are other Evelyn Nesbitt pages. Mine is American Eve. And the only thing I would say is I also have put up, various videos on YouTube that I did over the course of time. Some are just One is sort of a compilation of a condensation of the book and the chapters with titles, but they're all, for me, the thing about Evelyn is the images, you know, the photos of her. And other than that, I'm just continuing to, I'm teaching film and literature still as a professor emeritus at Hofstra University on Long Island. And you can contact me through my Hofstra email also. So that's eng.pmu@hofstra.edu. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that people have. Or and there's also if you want to see Evelyn in when she, the only video I've ever found of her, audio and video, is on YouTube. If you put in Evelyn Nesbitt, I'm No Man's Woman Now, it's a clip that a friend of mine who was helping me research found and has put on YouTube, and it shows Evelyn singing in a nightclub in Panama in the 1930s.
Wow. I really want to thank my guest today, Paula Oboru, and you need to go out and get her book on Evelyn Nesbitt. The photos alone are incredible, but the book is fantastic as well, and that's American Eve. So once again, thank you, Paula.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's always fun to talk to somebody who knows so much about this subject. So thank you.
And let me also thank my loyal listeners. There you go, folks, another episode of Murder Most Foul. If you enjoyed yourself today, I hope you'll tell your friends and family, and they can learn more about me and the podcast on the podcast's website. Not easy to say. And that's at www.murdermostfoul, all one word, no caps, no spaces, .com. And on that page, there's also an email link, so anyone can drop me a line. What you think of the podcast? Is there something I can do better? Maybe a case up till now I haven't heard about, and there are more and more out there every day. So until we meet again, take care. And for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.